Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I am a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. So I share ideas and strategies and roadmaps. I tell stories of things that worked, but also I've talked about my big epic fails that I've made along the way. And one of the things I love to do is interview people. And so for the last couple years, I've been doing a lot more interviews on this podcast, especially in areas where I will admit I am still learning so much. And one of those areas is AI. I've been interviewing for probably the last 4 years, a lot of different experts on AI. And the person that we're gonna talk to today is Angela Daniel. And she is truly an expert on this overlap of smart machines and learning. And I love it because she just has such a nuanced take for all of this. A little bit about who she is. Angela has been teaching students and designing professional development experiences for faculty and staff in public, private, and Montessori PK to 12 schools for more than 2 decades. Currently, she is at the MIT STEP Lab working with the RAICA team to produce a curriculum for middle school students to explore AI, the ethics surrounding AI, and students' own power in taking computational action. She is passionate about creating student-centered, inclusive learning in individual classrooms and in whole schools, equipping coaches and administrators to best support teachers who aim to facilitate deeper learning in their classrooms is her current research focus. Angela holds a BA in English from Rollins College and an MEd in school leadership from the Harvard Graduate School of Education. I really enjoyed this interview, and I hope that you get as much out of it as I did, because it was an honor to get to interview her.
When we think about this idea of AI, I think a lot of educators right now are feeling afraid, right? We talked about this ahead of time, that both of us will admit we're not AI experts. We don't engage, we've never designed AI. This isn't our background. We focus on learning. And so when we think about AI and where educators are at as they experience this, like what are you seeing? What do you notice? What are some of the emotions that you seem to see with how people are feeling about AI?
My experience with educators is going to be in the context of typically them being introduced to the middle school curriculum that mm-hmm. we developed. So there is a specific context to when I'm having conversations with teachers. And a lot of times the technology is new, I'd say most of the time. And and maybe there's not a lot of, at least they believe there's not a lot of definite information that they can mm-hmm. lean on, like objectively true information that they feel comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And then also a lot of times we're not working specifically with computer science trained teachers, even though they're working mm-hmm. in sort of computer science realm. And so then there's the aspect of engaging with the tools that are actually produced for this curriculum in particular, that that allow students to tinker with AI, things like, well, teachable machine is something that everyone would have access to, which is an image classification where you train a model and you test. You can test a model; it's really fun, mm-hmm. And so that's one of the tools that we use. And even just encountering that for the very first time is a little daunting, I guess. Uh-huh. It can be.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I think about is that, I'm seeing the same thing, and in so many ways, I appreciate it because it's what I've experienced myself, right? So it's fear, it's daunting, it's overwhelming, it's exciting, it makes me optimistic. across the board. I mean, it's so many of these different emotions. And you talked about this idea of just playing around with it a little bit. And I'm curious, like, what do you see, you know, because even if AI is not your expertise, instructional design, professional development, learning, those are your expertise. Like, what do you see as the value of just spending some time playing with a new tool like that?
Well, I don't think we can overstate the importance of playing in general as a learning tool for students. It certainly disarms them, this ability to go in and play around with something that you know you can't break, or that there's no high stakes associated with tinkering with it. But also this idea about AI being the intelligent part of AI being sort of the learning part, right? We establish a data set that can create path where we create data sets where we create models, and then those models are used to create patterns in the algorithm to be identified later. And so some of these things are really abstract, even for adults. And so I think having students get involved in the AI and seeing, oh, okay, so my data set was limited. The reason why it only picked up apples and not oranges is because I never introduced it to any oranges. Mm-hmm. So that's a great way to launch for, you know, inclusive data sets and how we accidentally introduce, or intentionally, hopefully not, but introduce bias into data sets and things like that. They can draw those conclusions on their own because they, you know, they're seeing the logic of the steps. And so, yeah, that's what we're really hoping for, because like I said, with these high level abstractions of AI, and I think that's what daunts some adults too, is I don't really understand what the AI is doing. And so therefore I don't want to talk about AI or think about AI. As long as it stays in the realm of the mysterious, then it's not something that we can really hook into. But with students, yeah, giving them something concrete that they can say, okay, that's what it was doing. It was looking for, you know, my thumb being up, or, you know, something really that concrete. And then they can make some generalizations based on that.
You know, it's interesting when you brought up the area of bias, right? One of the things I see that concerns me with students, and I think the same thing happens with adults, is there is an assumption somehow, and I think it's maybe cultural assumptions. Maybe it's, you know, for me, it's watching Data on Star Trek TNG as a kid. Like, I was a nerd, so I'll just say that. I am a nerd. that has never changed. But there's sort of the notion that AI is going to be objective and unbiased, right? And that's simply not the case. And so how do you think teachers can help students not just learn that and see that that's a reality, but discover the reality that actually AI has biases. AI has these flaws that we need to recognize.
Yeah, I think that's really tough. I mean, we do hope that AI can be unbiased. It will never be objective, however.
Yeah.
and it is, it's a much larger problem than the problem of AI. Because human beings are creating data sets and gathering data sets and selecting what goes in and what doesn't go into a data set. Mm-hmm. And just very, very recently, there was a New York Times opinion piece by Ezra Klein that really illuminates this, which is a lot of the things that scare us about the technology of AI really have less to do with the technology of AI and more to do with the way that AI is going to be used in business models and security models and things like that. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about introducing students to the importance of this idea that bias does happen, and most of the time, I think it's, especially when we're talking about students, it is unintentional. They just literally didn't think about how they can include as much data as possible, even when they're building their very small data sets for their own experimentation. I think that all by itself makes sense to students, especially when they ferret out that it didn't get, they got their thumb, but it didn't get their friend's thumb because maybe their friend's thumb is a little bit smaller than theirs, or maybe they're differently complected. And so students can, in their tinkering, come to this. But as far as the larger question of bias, it really, it's hard to talk about without also talking about traditional representation in computer science, and also, you know, power dynamics with regard to who owns the data sets, who owns the, you know, who owns the algorithm, and that becomes more complicated than we get into with our curriculum. But I certainly would see where adults would be interested in that. I know I am.
I'm. It's interesting that you said that, because I think there is a really interesting. I read this book called Mother of Invention, right? And she is a feminist historian that looks at the story of technology and the negative side of gender bias. For example, why we should have had electric cars from the beginning, why oil wasn't necessarily a better option, but how it became gendered that electric cars were female. And I'm talking early 1900s, right? So the way that the computer was a term for women who did computations, and that they literally referred to, you know, women power, how many women it's replacing. The gender bias throughout it has been cultural, right? Like it's been this pervasive aspect. And so it just reminds me of, like, if we're going to have students tackle these realities of changing the bias within their data sets or recognizing the bias within a chat bot, it also, to me, means like they just have to also know how to find bias within the history of design, right? Bias within how this has always been the case, because if it's an isolated skill, like go find the loaded words, it's going to be treated as an activity, not a larger mindset that we have to have in life, right?
Right. Yeah, it is sort of ironic that AI is designed to identify patterns. And really, that's what we really want for students. Can you look at the history? Okay, let's say we have a class of 40 students, so we've all built a data set, and we all test them, and the same students are always not identified, you know, in our trial of our thumbs up. If that's true, then we have a pattern, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we can do is we can look at our model and say, is there a pattern in our models? Or is this some glitch in this program? Because if there's a pattern in our models that we're not including enough data to have this particular thing or this particular person represented, then we have to ask ourselves, why is it that we would all accidentally leave out, you know, this very important data? And then that just begs the larger question. Do you think this happens in other places? Do you think other people forget whole segments of, like, of people to design for, or things to design for, or contingencies designed for? And I think especially middle school students, I love working with middle school students because they're moving into that place where they can make those generalizations. Like, I made this error. Maybe someone else is making this error too. And maybe they're even making it for the same reason, because they just didn't think about it. And so anyway, I think that's such a fun opportunity and an important opportunity. And really what we're talking about is simply applying critical thinking skills and new frameworks for those critical thinking and applying it to some of these older questions of fairness, accessibility, equity, and things like that. Just, you know, with a new tool.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I'm struck by as you describe that in the tool and, you know, having students make sense out of, you know, sort of discovering the bias on their own, recognizing the way it works, is just the broader idea of AI in general and how this has been a long time coming, right? And, you know, one of the regrets I have in my own blog is that I've referred to it as the AI revolution, right? But it's really been the AI evolution. Like this newest iteration of generative AI feels different for sure. AI based on neural networks feels different, and it is. The level of machine learning is different. So all of these things are different. But I'm reminded that if AI is essentially at its core smart algorithms, that our social media is a more primitive version of AI. Spellcheck is AI. You know, and people who say things like, I don't know if I would trust AI. Like I talked to someone the other day who, and he said, I just don't know if I would trust AI to handle some of the really important things like a self-driving car. Mm. And I get where he was coming from. That feels scary, but I did ask him, you know, like, well, how did you meet like your significant other? Like how did, well, and it was like on an app, which was AI, right? Like he trusted an AI to, you know, how do you organize your music? Well, it's on playlists and I love the recommendations on Spotify. That's AI. Well, you know, tell me about travel, and travel is just fueled by AI from the AI running the autopilot, which is not what they call it, but you know, the autopilot of the plane itself to, the way that they set prices to the check-in system. It's so pervasive that it's so, it's just all around. Like it's just this invisible thing that is around us, that we live in an era of algorithms. And this, I feel like there's something about saying and recognizing this feels big, and it is big. I don't minimize it, but this is just another iteration of a process that's been around for years. Right. And I think that there's this element that when we recognize we're already using AI in our lives, it sort of has a disarming effect. I don't know. Does that make sense? Like I feel like there's this recognition of like, oh, what we're seeing now isn't completely a revolution. It's just another iteration of this process that's been going on for decades.
I agree. I think understanding that it's in the atmosphere and that it's not foreign to us. Uh-huh. But I think that there is a moment where you start to understand that AI is getting closer to approaching a more human-like,
yeah,
evaluative. And when I say human-like, I don't mean like a human, but human-looking. Let's say that human, yeah, human-presenting. Mm-hmm. Type of behavior and type of decision making. Mm-hmm. I mean, having said that, and even with the generative AI, there are still things that human beings do that we haven't figured out how to teach a computer do. And one of them is to be curious about something. They are excellent at many things that are, like I said, they are approaching looking more human in the, mm-hmm, in the thinking. I would say our human thinking, their processing. I want to be really careful with that language, because I think it, sometimes the way we, just as lay people, you know, in the grocery store talking, yeah, about, yeah, AI thinking, that might be alarming to some people, and rightfully so, because it's not thinking. That's not what it's doing. Mm-hmm. It is processing, and, yeah, and that can look a lot like thinking, but, mm-hmm, but it's processing based on, an accumulation of information and an instruction, mm-hmm, of what to do with that information. And so, but yeah, I think that, like I said, that recognition of how close it's approaching human presenting, mm-hmm, can be alarming. And so like you with the, talking to your friend, we actually had a report from a middle school classroom that, one of our middle school classroom teachers asked if they would trust a completely autonomous vehicle to drive them around. And, uh-huh, this is I think it was a seventh grade classroom, and the students, most of them said, absolutely not. I would want a human still sitting there where they could, uh-huh, grab the wheel. And then one of the students actually pulled up data on car accidents and, mm-hmm, human-induced car accidents versus autonomous, mm-hmm, vehicle accidents, and was trying to make the point that actually you're much safer in the autonomous car, just you know, statistically, and this idea that a well-trained autonomous vehicle might operate in the same way that a very well-trained driver would. And a very well-trained driver, although very trustworthy, is not going to be infallible. And that's probably where we are with autonomous vehicles too. But it was interesting to hear that same debate in a middle school classroom. And I think you and I, the last time we talked about the robot that played Go and ended up winning against the master in Go, and how it won not because it necessarily had more skills, but because it was willing to disregard some patterns and traditions that humans would acknowledge and be aware of. And I think that that's something that makes human beings comfortable. Like, regardless of statistically, like, you know, the statistical likelihood of being safe. I like the fact that a human driver knows that a person might cross the crosswalk without, without the sign, or, you know, or that, it's really rude to follow someone, you know, closer than 12 feet or something like that. Mm-hmm. Some arbitrary, you know, more that we hold to be, an axiom that maybe a computer would be like, well, that's not ideal though. I'm gonna, you know, I'll idealize this.
Well, I'm reminded of the, I can't remember the name of it, but do you remember when there were the two, this is essentially a negotiation between two AI bots, and they were just, so much more brutal in terms of their ability to negotiate, breaking social norms that we would never do. They didn't have any of the biases. I love behavior economics. They didn't have any of the biases about, you know, this is worth more to me because I've had it for a while. Do you know what I mean? Like, but they also used some of those tactics. And then at one point there was the big to-do was that they just stopped using normal language. And What's going on here? Do you remember this? Like, and it was like, did they invent their own language? Is there this shorthand going on? What was that? And there was a big debate about all of it, but it was a reminder of, something like negotiation is going to look so different with AI than humans, because, and again, this is me not being an AI expert, but from what I see, you brought up, you know, what AI doesn't do well in terms of its processing versus actual human cognition is the affective side, the empathy side, the recognition and the pull of social norms. You can program that, but, you know, it's not going to have that completely. The deeper, immediate contextual understanding of what of the situation, that context piece. And so it just, it was this weird, like, recognition of, oh, these are machines, right? Like, this, as human-like as they may be, there is a difference between that and the way humans negotiate. They're just vastly different, you know?
I do. And it makes me think too, that as we approach human presentation in AI, who will be responsible for programming in these pro-social behaviors? And if that's a thing that we need, and I think it is when we talk about social robots and conversational agents and things like that, we want those pro-social appearing norms and behaviors to be there, because that makes us comfortable, right? We wouldn't want to talk to something that was staring us straight in the face without blinking for minutes at a time, because that would be really uncomfortable, or other larger things. But that also makes me, I don't know, it kind of amuses me to think about, in programming those, where will we pull those from? Like, who gets to say what a social norm is and what a pro-social behavior is? And because, I mean, there are people, you know, now and always have been, that have very different ideas about that. And I mean, I think that'll be a very ripe area to think about bias and inclusion and representation, fairness, kindness. You know, is kindness something we want our computers to present with? What does kindness even look like? How do we define kindness in that in that kind of way. I think that all of those things are fascinating. And maybe
even the cultural differences. I mean, I just think about like when I was in the Netherlands, the cultural norm, and again, these are so variable, like it's different from person to person, but when I was in the Netherlands, there's a bluntness that's just a cultural norm in the Netherlands that we don't have in the US. And my example was, I said, someone asked me if I liked the TV show Breaking Bad. And my favorite shows are, I like positive character arcs. So The Good Place, Ted Lasso, like Schitt's Creek. Like, I like shows where people become better, not worse. So my answer was, well, it's not my favorite. And he said, I didn't ask you if it was your favorite. I asked you if you like it, which according to the Dutch norms, like, that's not weird. Like, you just tell me if you like it or not. But in the US, like, we don't say, no, I don't like that show. We would say something like, well, that's not my favorite. Mm-hmm. We talk around it, you know? And it's weird to think of, like you said, pro-social. Is the AI going to ask that kind of a follow-up question? Like, is that going to be rude, or is it going to be too polite? Like, is it going to, how blunt do we want it to be? Like, even something as small as that, that's a fascinating area to explore.
Yeah. And would need a lot of AI to figure that out too. Intent reasoning and probably reinforcement learning and, voice recognition and all of the things. I mean, you're talking about a very complicated AI system that would even do something like that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the interesting things that I've noticed is, as AI presents as more human, and as you bring up this idea of it being more pro-social and interacting in a way that's very human, there's been a long history of that, right? Like, for me, I think of Clippy, right? Like, Clippy pops up and just it's basically a table of contents, but it feels like it's this thing that pops up and says hi. But one of the things I was struck with is the longer I used Clippy, the less like an anthropomorphized paperclip it became, and the more it became just the tool that I use, right? And then I think about when I first had Siri, I would talk to Siri like Siri was a person. Thank you, Siri. I appreciate that. And then then next thing you know, a couple years later, you're just like, I'm not going to say that phrase, but you know, I just say that and then a voice to text and then it pops up. Mm-hmm. And my level of, I guess I would say, my own personal politeness toward Siri has changed. And one of the things I wonder about when it comes to things like chatbots in particular is to what extent are students and people in general going to sort of humanize them and interact with them in a way that feels very natural and human, versus to what extent will they function closer to setting up command prompts in Linux or doing a search engine in Google, or do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be really interesting to see the next generation that's raised with these, to see on that continuum from more human to more tool-like, where are they going to be in that?
Yeah. And what will be the consequence of that with regard to our own, like, our habituated behaviors with even toward each other, right? I don't know. It reminds me of, I was looking at a personal AI device for young children. They read together. And mm-hmm. And what was striking about it was that the child would read a passage and the device would say, wow, that was really great. You're a great reader. And then it would be their turn. And in this particular video clip, the young girl responded and said, you're a really good reader too. And had this, really adorable and kind exchange with an agent. But yeah, I definitely think that there will be research studies at some point about how our behaviors are adapted and modified based on those things. Like, and even I think, the phone assistant is one of them, but even lights in a house now. I was at a friend's house not too long ago, and their oldest child could turn on all the lights just by saying, you know, yeah, lights, calling the assistant and turning on the lights. And it was very, I mean, very Star Trek. And at the same time though, with no effort whatsoever made toward politeness, kindness, appreciation, or anything like that. And I mean, because it's not necessary, you know, the assistant's just waiting to turn on the light for you. But yeah, that is a really great question. Hopefully someone will do research on that. I know even now, and before, but really now the research around the way that, phones being at arm's length reach from young, you know, adolescents is we're starting to understand the ramifications of that. There will be ramifications of the other as well, which brings us back to the point of why it's important that we're talking about this with young people and with the people who talk to young people.
Yes.
Because if we are inundated by it, if it is our atmosphere now, then we equip ourselves and inform ourselves by understanding where it's presenting, what it's being used for, what are we paying for it? And I mean the exchange of our data or the exchange of our privacy, and having this be in the collective body of understanding so that more voices can weigh in. And when I say more voices, you know, I mean the traditional voices, adults who are interested, but I also think that it's important for young people, even particularly young people, to be informed enough to where they can at least begin to understand that we want them to know and to have some position on this.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting. One of the things that I think about from your example of the book thing is, you know, that's giving the student or the kid immediate feedback, right? But then I look at that and think, well, what is the underlying, this is me, what is the underlying pedagogy of that feedback? Like, what is the underlying approach? And, you know, one of the things I was struck by was like, is that AI being encouraging, or is it accidentally reinforcing either inaccurate information, the student's not reading correctly, or is it by stating you're a good reader, accidentally encouraging a growth mindset, right? And so it's a weird thing to think of. Like there's this teacher side of me, right? That I can never escape being a teacher, that looks at things like, I love the fact that people can use a chatbot and interact with it and get it can clarify concepts really well in almost every subject area, right? It does a really good job at that. It can restate it at a younger age level, you can get skill practice created. There's so many positive things where it becomes like a virtual tutor in many respects. But then there's this side of me that looks at it and says, well, what's the cost of that? And what's the pedagogy of that? Like, is the cost of that, that in the process, they're getting so much immediate meaningful feedback that there's not the struggle that's necessary in learning? Or is the feedback that they're getting such clear answers that they don't get to wade through the confusion that is a part of the learning process, right? Or is there this cost of it where maybe it's giving good answers, but the underlying learning theory or pedagogy behind it is non-existent, right? It's just pulling from a neural network, and therefore you realize, well, ChatGPT is not a teacher. Do you see what I mean? Like, so I mentioned this because my oldest was using ChatGPT to understand something in statistics that he just had a hard time with. Like, he was not getting Z scores. He was looking, and he just needed examples, clarifying questions, and then it asked it to give him a something that he could put into a spreadsheet, and he did it. And I'm telling you, it was amazing, right? But I also thought if I was training a math tutor, one of the conversations I would have is, what is the best way to learn math, right?
Yeah.
And so that's something I wrestle with a little bit, and I'm not sure that there's an easy answer to it.
Yeah, I don't know. That makes some assumptions about where the place that AI belongs and doesn't belong. And you and I could also talk about the value of like just an emotional, the emotional component of learning and how learning with a robot is, you know, is going to be different. Now, in the case of the little girl, you'll be happy to know she was actually doing it perfectly, which for the feedback. But yeah, the this idea, and I also though, I think we could have had this conversation around parental help too. So like, and. Although, I don't know, you and I could both argue that like when, especially when we're talking about learning, there are so many layers of value, right? Not just the content learning or the skill learning, but also that social interaction, you know, did you learn by working in a group? What did you learn by having negotiate that ending? What did you have to learn by having your mom give you an answer in a way that you weren't ready to hear that answer? Or, you know what I mean? There are so many things that we learn around our learning too. And so that are valuable well beyond the actual answer. And I think that's exactly the point you were making. And yeah, I think that teachers will always, when I say always, I mean, who am I, right? I think teachers, there will be a place for people who are in, who are obsessively interested in the way human beings learn and create relationships around the things they learn. And, and even how it resonates with them, which is one reason why I think, especially when we're talking about AI, I think intellectualizing has its place with AI. But I also think operating with it and building a project with it and taking it apart and tinkering with it has a place. And we have a sort of a policy of placeful embodiment. So if an AI agent is creating a neural network, or, you know, if we're creating a neural network that does certain things, we have students do those things. Like, what does it feel like to pass your, you know, pattern through multiple layers of students and have them kind of embody that activity? Because we, first of all, for understanding, but also for all of those other things, right? The social interactive aspect, and for making concrete things that are invisible, and all of the other things that are so fun about education and learning together.
So one of the things, I guess I have two final questions. If you have, let's imagine that there's a teacher who has just seen ChatGPT, and that's the big focus. ChatGPT. It's what everyone's talking about. It's kids are going to cheat. It's all of these conversations, hard conversations. Parents are coming. And they come to you and say, look, I'm concerned about all of these, but I don't really know at a base level what AI is and how it's changing learning. What would you say to that person?
AI, first of all, AI is a huge broad term. So yes, I think it makes perfect sense that someone wouldn't be able to say what AI actually is and how it's changing learning, because it's different. It's different things, right? Mm-hmm. And I, with the ChatGPT, I mean, I guess it depends on how it's being used. Like, your son used it in one way. I know many people are using it in an entertainment way. Just like, you know, write me a poem about what I should do on Saturday. And then you also have the, like, kind of the perennial fear of it's going to write essays for us, and you know, and we are no longer going to generate writing on our own, and things like that. And I think that particular, I don't know, there's a great TikTok actually with an English teacher who's grading assignments that he gave to ChatGPT as if they were in his, I think, AP literature class. And it was really well done. But and he makes good points, which is just like with any cheating mechanism, if we're going to get down to brass tacks, I was an English teacher. Typically, there will be a tell, you know, that a student will use. In his case, ChatGPT said this scene in Hamlet sets up this the ending of Hamlet. And he's like, my students wouldn't know that because we haven't read the ending. So boom, you know, F or whatever. And, you know, there's that. But also, and you and I have talked about this before, we always run into danger of cheating in a myriad of different circumstances. And one of them is, you know, students run out of time or students feel the pressure is too high, or there could be all sorts of things. But one of them for sure is if they don't feel that the assignment is meaningful, if they don't feel like they're going to benefit from the assignment. Now, we could argue that students might not be the ideal person to determine whether or not that assignment is going to deliver to them the promised, you know, skills. But what I think we're going to find is that regardless of ChatGPT or any kind of other generative AI, just like art, which has been around, you know, generative art AI has been around for a long time. There are still people who paint. I actually still paint and I'm terrible at it, but I don't foster it out. And there are always going to be reasons that we write, and they might be, I mean, maybe they've become more in the realm of personal. I can't even imagine to give you sort of a parameter of this, but that's always, we're always going to be that because we're creative beings, and that's something that we do. So I think like if it were in my class, if I were still teaching English right now and I was still asking my students to write, and I know that they could use ChatGPT to do it, I would probably lean into the idea of creating very personally related assignments, or using it, have it write the assignment, and then use it as a base for leaping off of. And I steal that directly from an adult who does that very thing. So let ChatGPT fill the blank page. Now I'm no longer anxious, and I will just go in and change 80% of, you know, what it is. Is that great? Is that a great lesson plan? You know, probably not, but it is something to think about. It's something I would be thinking about. How about you?
Yeah. I mean, I think I generally think like knowing that artificial intelligence is not a machine version of the human mind. Like, I think that's like, and I would begin with understanding, it's about algorithms and it's about adaptive algorithms, and maybe just a base level, like that's probably how I would explain it, saying like the key thing that's different is now instead of programming just algorithms to do if then, they're learning, and the learning component is different, and a discussion about that. One of the things I love about the curriculum that you shared, I don't know how much you're allowed to share here, but is I love the fact that it engages students in understanding the nature of automation, AI, these components. And I think, you know, it's a little bit like, I feel like my students learned media literacy and information literacy better because they were in my journalism class, because the act of composing helps you learn it, right? And so I kind of think like for teachers, you know, what you shared before with me, and again, I know how much you're allowed to share, but so much of that curriculum gets students discovering and understanding by doing and playing. And it really is the nature of what does this mean? What does this look like? And I think that's a sharp departure from just saying, here's what AI is. How would we create a student-friendly version of it and then have kids use it? Like what you're describing is really getting to the nature of it.
Yeah, so I'm allowed to talk about it. We're actually quite proud of it. MIT, the STEP Lab at MIT has a project that I'm on called RICA, a Responsible AI for Computational Action. It's currently a middle school curriculum that does exactly what John just said it does. So thanks. But also one of the things that I love about it too, I mean, granted I'm on it, so I'm very enthusiastic about it for so many reasons, but one of them is the fact that teachers can come to this curriculum with no AI knowledge, mm-hmm. and it creates a co-learning structure between the facilitator and the class, which, you know, I mean, you and I, that's like our jam, right? Like get those students in the center, create a facilitator relationship. Let's have some fun together learning, alongside one another and, in this space. So one of our partner teachers, because the curriculum is not available widely yet. It mm-hmm. will be soon. And because it's coming from MIT's STEP Lab, it will be free and open to whomever wants to access it, it and all of its resources. But one of our teacher partners that's trying it out for us said to us that it actually feels a lot more like game instructions than like a lesson plan, because there is some adaptivity and things like that, which is really important, because when you're talking about something that's so new, like AI, mm-hmm. I think it's really important that teachers are able to lean into their strengths. If you're an art teacher or humanities teacher, wouldn't it be great if you could use that expertise you're bringing to the classroom to inform the activities your students are doing. And that's really where we are. And so, it is a curriculum for middle school students, but I like to think of it as a curriculum for teachers. It's certainly not a script. So anyway, we're very proud of it. And we're actually expanding it upward. So we're going to get to see what it feels like to work with students who grow up a little farther into AI too. So, we're very excited about it.
Oh, that's great stuff. So I just want to say thank you for this conversation. I knew I kind of told you ahead of time. It's going to be very conversational. We're both going to talk and it's not going to look like a normal Q&A podcast. But I really appreciate you sharing your ideas, your wisdom, your experiences, your perspectives. And I hope other people got as much out of this conversation as I did.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right. Well, there we have it. That was Angela Daniel sharing her wisdom and expertise on AI, what it means for learning, and how we can help students learn about the nature of AI. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify or wherever it is that you listen to your podcast? That would mean the world to me. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.